Hello and welcome to Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb, and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. This season, we'll also be showcasing some of the area's musical talent, with tracks from local artists being played in each podcast. This week, we've got music from singer-songwriter Taylor T. As ever, your comments, reviews and feedback are always appreciated. And if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guests this week have collectively been at the centre of the Somerset drinks industry for 50 years. Julian and Matilda Templey are two of the country's most prominent faces in the world of cider and cider brandy. Their passion and expertise for creating the highest quality drinks through the most natural and traditional methods has seen their product grace the tables of Michelin star restaurants and the fields of Glastonbury Festival with their iconic cider bus. Julian, Matilda, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have just had the first summer bank holiday. Do you have any family bank holiday traditions?
Family bank holidays traditions are mostly deciding who's going to work in the cider house selling cider. No, other than that, we sort of bicker about whether we're going to be open for cider or not, and then generally open for cider. So selling cider would be our only bank holiday tradition.
Well, this year's long weekend was very much a long anticipated bit of sunshine, so hopefully there's a lot of people
it was
out
great.
For a drink.
It really felt like the first weekend of summer,
yeah.
Long-awaited summer.
Speaking of family, Julian, you were born into a family of esteemed academics. Your grandfather was a historian, your father was a mathematician. What are your early memories of family life?
Well, I was born in Scotland, Forsyth, where my father was working for the Admiralty on, I think, a Tigerfish torpedo and general explosions. I was brought up in Cambridge, where my father was then, it was after the war, presumably working in as an academic. So Cambridge was somewhere I look at with great fondness. And I went to school, the local choir school. Not that I could sing, but academic work was never particularly high on my achievements. I suppose that I carried a candle at one of the Christmas carol services. I was very much a grandson of a university. My father was brought up in Kingsbury Episcopi. His mother died when he was 7. And he lived in his family home, which my daughter lives in now, or one daughter lives in now. And we've lived in this village for the last, certainly since 1770. My father's family was what is now Bradford's, the building merchants. So his mother was a historian. Anyway, she did one of the first histories of Somerset and wrote books about Somerset and died very young. But Cambridge has always been a part of the first 13 years of my life was spent in a village just outside Cambridge called Grantchester.
As a child, did you visit Somerset? Did you spend time down here?
Yes, we always came down to see my great aunt, Thorney, which is, say, the other end of the village. And in those days, people didn't go abroad. So we had a drive from Cambridge to here, which took God knows how many hours. And it was always considered to be the family home. We had all sorts of relations round about the place. Distantly, I'm actually related to most of the people in the village. We all seem to have a lady called Billa Mayall in common. Certainly we have her portrait at the house the other end of the village. And is where the Bradford family, or the Bradford, the bullion merchants, started. So anyway, the links to Somerset are long.
You mentioned that the academic life was not something that was high on your agenda. So I take it that you were never inspired or never sort of tempted to go into that route and follow your father's footsteps.
Somebody in their family has to be thick, shouldn't they? And I'm very practical, but my father was very much an absent-minded university professor, and his academic career caused him to go on to be part of the nuclear science. And but in my early years, he used to be teaching in America. So I suppose he had to find a way to earn enough money to keep his family, as all our parents did. It wasn't an easy life in those days. But academia for me was not really an option.
Matilda, by the time you arrived on the scene, Burrow Hill Cider was very much up and running. What are your early memories of life here?
The farm was very different when we were, the ethos was very much the same, but it was very much smaller, and there was cider customers to torment and geese running around and siblings to fight with. So I think the neighbours all considered us completely feral children. So we had a free childhood out on the farmyard. And it really is much the same as the Julian's grandchildren are living now.
The family element of the farm is very evident from everything that you do. What were some of the ways that you got involved as a young child?
We used to sell cider in the cider house when we were about 10. That wouldn't be allowed now, but that was our Saturday job, selling cider. And we would be, there'd be goats to milk in the mornings. And I think the farm's evolved a lot over time. So there's all through adolescence, we were out selling cider brandy at shows, and then at university I'd sell cider brandy on the side. So there's always something to do on the farm. Lambing, we did lots of lambing, small children with small hands, good for lambing. So bits of everything.
So Julian, you kept them all busy.
I hope so. I think it's I can credit myself with giving them something of a work ethic. Whether they're pleased about that, I'm not sure. But they've all prospered in their own ways.
Matilda, when you were a little bit older, maybe as a teenager, at selling cider brandy at those markets, did you think you would be as involved in the farm and the business over the long term?
I think I probably always felt that I would come back to the business in one way or another. I was never very good at settling at anything. And I'd always come back for seasonal work throughout my university career and then when I was working. So it was a natural progression. It happened, and then when I came back full time, it happened pretty fast.
Before we talk about everything that happens here, I'd like to spend a little bit of time on your photography. Had you always been a keen photographer, and what sort of inspired you into it?
No, I'd always taken photos, but I wasn't a keen photographer, and I used to work for the London School of Tropical Medicine, which is where I studied, and I was working and thinking, this is, actually, I've studied this and it's not the life I want, and I felt quite restricted. I was living in Uganda and decided I wanted to change my life. I had a lot of time to think because I was working in the field very much on my own. And I thought photography, if I was good at writing, I'd have been tried for journalism. But I thought photography would be great because I could work as a photojournalist. And I knew absolutely nothing. So I moved back to London, called myself a photographer, and clawed my way up the hard way. through sheer naivety. I wouldn't do it like that again, but it was fun at the time.
A lot of your work, at least that I've seen, maybe away from more of the fashion stuff that you do, is in black and white. Why do you think that you favour that mode of presenting your work?
I think it's easier to see a story in a picture in black and white. And when I was doing my commercial work, that was always had to be in full colour. So black and white was like a hobby on the side. And you can look at a picture, you see the story straight away, and it can be more striking. And I think the black and white images lend themselves to more graphic scenes, like, for example, the Somerset floods.
Thank you for bringing that up. Your first book was a collection that captured the 2014 floods, a time that was painful and devastating for a great many number of people. How did you go about telling those stories in an empathetic way?
My mum actually gave me a call. I was out of the country and she said, you must come back and photograph these floods. And I said, like everybody else, it floods every year. It will be gone by the time I get back. And she said, no, it's really something we've not seen before. And so I came back, and because I'm part of this community, I went into the village and basically started knocking on the neighbours' doors saying, can I come and photograph you? And then I sent it to the local news agents and they said, absolutely not interested, we're not even going to open it. Somerset floods, that's last week's news. And I said, it's really not something that we haven't seen before. And then no one even opened the package of pictures. And so I sent some images to the papers, and then the floods got worse and worse and worse. So actually, the story just carried on. And so then there suddenly was a huge demand for images. But just being part of the community meant that I had a huge advantage in taking photos, because my grandfather's house was flooded, the family home, and so we were all affected and in the same boat. And then actually, as the floods progressed, I ended up showing around lots of journalists, because it was quite hard to navigate the roads around here because of the floods. So I went from sort of photographing to being a journalist tour guide during the floods, and it meant that people could use me to tell their stories, and that really helped, because people really wanted their stories told, because it was the second year in a row that the flooding had happened, and we knew at that time that it wasn't because of a crazy rainfall, it was just a mismanagement of the rivers in 2014.
Julian, one of the pictures is quite striking of you in your father's house in Thorney, where you might potentially be seeing the funny side of things. Do you think there's anything in the Somerset culture, personality, archetype that equips people to go through that, to sort of plough through it?
No, it was just, I don't can't see anything. How we evolved to not be angry. It was a huge bureaucratic cock-up. The chairman of the Environment Agency was called Lord Smith, who left being a failed Labour minister to a monstrously profitable job in various public services. For health reasons, he couldn't actually visit Somerset in the floods, and he seems to have said, if I remember rightly, that there was no real problem, it was just a bunch of troublemakers. And I think he came to Somerset without Wellington boots as well, but totally unsympathetic. People were angry, not so much as the floods, but also the incompetence that got us in the position. There was a sort of contradiction of responsibilities, which the Environment Agency decided they had two different roles, the conservation and protecting from floods, and they thought the two were in opposition. So they took the view that dredging the river was interfering with nature, And so we were told at the time not to refer it as dredging or the river. We were told to return it as cleaning the drain, because all these sort of conservationists seemed to think that the river was put there by God and it was nature and must be left in peace. Instead, the river had been dredged since its Roman times, and the banks had been built up, and there was no contradiction or no opposition as far as conservation is concerned. The river was something to be looked after.
I think they were so incredibly patronising to the local community. There was this huge uprising, and there was a real blitz spirit with people being in the floods, those people caught up in their houses in the floods. There's people living upstairs in their houses for 2 months with no facilities, no services, no running water, no sewage. And so this community uprising ended up being a Facebook group that had 50,000 people, and these were 50,000 incredibly active people. So everybody in the community jumped in and agitated, and it became a group that the Environment Agency and the government couldn't ignore. So with this community uprising, everyone sharing information, everybody being involved on a daily basis, it turned around and the government ended up apologising. They had sent a spokesman on TV that said, "We're so sorry. It was entirely the Environment Agency's fault. We're sorry. We mistreated the people of Somerset." But it took two or three months to get to the stage where the Environment Agency wasn't saying, "Oh, well, they're bog trotters. They deserve to flood every now and again."
Your second Somerset book then was the next chapter, I suppose, if you will, what happened next, and more of a celebration of those people and that community. So A View from the Hill was actually instrumental in this podcast being created, the way in which it takes pride in the people and in their stories, and it sits on our coffee table in the middle of our living room. Can you talk me through your approach to showing a portrait of Somerset's people in that way?
It was actually, this was an amazing thing. So I really fell in love with, back in love with Somerset during the Somerset floods because of this community spirit. And then the Rural Life Museum got in touch with me, and Somerset Museum said, "Would you do an exhibition on Somerset?" And I said, "I would love to, but what do you want?" And they said, "Whatever interests you about Somerset." And I thought it was a dream thing. So I spent a couple of days a month going around, and I went all over the place. I went over to Exmoor. I photographed a really diverse bunch of things, and then actually when I came to look at them, I realized I didn't have any knowledge of anything in Somerset outside this area, because to me Somerset is what you can see from this hill behind us here, Borough Hill, which is the Somerset Levels and its surrounds. And Exmoor is a very different thing, feels like a different universe up there. And so I realised that I sort of jettisoned the rest of it and just concentrated on what I knew and what inspired me about Somerset, which is this sort of collection of interesting characters and communities just around this area. And then because I had so many pictures, I thought, well, if I put it in a book, then it'll live forever. So that's what I did.
Julian, you bought what was then Passvale Farm at the age of 24, 25. Why?
I travelled the world and spent some time in Kenya. Possibly I learned what farming I know about in Kenya. But I wanted to look at farming. And then my great aunt died, and my family were doing up the house, and she left me a little bit of money, which provided the seed corn for me to buy this farm when, borrow the rest when it came up for sale. So, it must have been a crazy thing to do.
I had no idea you were so young when you came here.
But I was supported by my parents. And looking back on it, it must have been crackers. But I have some land that has always been in the family. But it floods, and so it's economically not very useful. But the idea of high ground, if you were going to play in agriculture in any shape or form, is essential. And to find a hill in Somerset is a bit extreme, but anyway, I ended up the owner of Parcel Farm, Borough Hill. And I'm forever grateful, I think. The farm had always made cider, and it had an immensely good name for making cider, but only on a very small scale. And we've gradually, over the years, cider activities have taken over everything. I mean, we still keep sheep, but we were sort of 4.5 acres of orchard. We're now 180. And we've developed things which are still in the cider world and found a niche market. On a good day when the sun's out, we feel moderately successful. But it has been an adventure.
Well, it's been a lifetime's work, really, hasn't it? What do you remember about the auction of the farm itself?
Nothing really much happened, except it didn't get to its reserve price. And so I came to see the Duck family afterwards and offered them what their asking price was. This was a time when land seemed expensive, but looking back in history, it was remarkably reasonable. So, the price, looking at an acre as this, was quite high, but looking to what happened afterwards, it wasn't a bad deal.
Did you have a clear idea, a clear picture of what you wanted to do, or did things happen a bit more spontaneously?
No, cider was, in those days, no more than a bolt-on. It was a number of years, really, before cider activities came to the fore.
They had ducks and geese and all sorts, didn't you?
We had sheep as well. We've always had sheep. And cows, but farming has become a little bit more boring now. This was a sort of tiny mixed for farm, and as we've developed the cider strand, it's provided us with all sorts of interesting things. But there was certainly a lot of cock-ups along the way. We cider activities are evolving the whole time. The market is changing considerably. Farming gets essentially a bit more boring and bigger. And cider making has proved to be a fascinating niche. So we wanted to make cider that would either go onto a dinner table like a wine. And essentially ended up by distilling to make a brandy, which has found a home in some of the best restaurants in the land.
So where did the idea for distilling and reintroducing cider brandy come about?
Well, the first records we can find of cider brandy are 1678. There's a book on cider called Treatise to Cider by a guy called Wooldridge. And that treats cider distilling as a normal part of the cider world. But so cider has a long history. But I mean, also going to France, say, playing cider and looking at apples and things, people would ask, why didn't we distill? And people have always asked, why didn't we distill? And the answer was, we didn't want to go to prison. But in France, they just looked to total amazement that there were no English apple distilleries. But the combination of the two things meant that in the late 80s, we decided to ask the government whether a farm could have a distillery. Up to that time, the laws sort of said a distillery for alcohol had to be around about the size of a small oil refinery. They wouldn't sanction licensing anything smaller than that. Partly because going into Europe meant the customers sort of thought they would have to be a bit more sensible in the future. And some of the leftovers from Mrs. Thatcher's policies, where she thought she was a decentraliser, meant that the authorities felt they ought to take a bit more look at the problem again and take a bit more relaxed view of the matter. But by the late 80s, we had license for a commercial distillery, and immensely supportive from our local customs were really very good. So we ended up with a cider distillery, which is part of the cider story. And it's important to us that the provenance and cider is there, and we are cider brandy, not apple brandy. Because cider is something which is a common and has a long history, and that hopefully is what we are preserving. So we've endeavoured to do justice to the story of cider.
Can you talk me through the process of distilling and aging and how you end up with the product?
So we grow around 1,000 tons of apples a year, and we turn all of those apples into, or the majority of those apples, into cider. And half of that cider we then distill. So once it's dry cider, and it has to be the best of dry cider, has to be, have no faults, you don't add anything to it, it's just pure juice cider, and it goes into our stills, Josephine, Fifi or Isabel, and it goes in the top and is fed through, and the distiller fires up the stills in the morning. They take about an hour to get going and keeps the temperature steady, and then eventually that 6% cider is continuously boiled. The steam separates into the high volatiles and the low volatiles and the mid volatiles, and what you get is you condense out a 70% spirit. So the 6% cider comes out on a continuous process as 70% spirit, which is known as apple eau de vie, and that apple eau de vie then goes and sits in barrels for between 3 and 20 years, and after 3 years it's allowed to be called a brandy.
And is it like other spirits where you choose the barrels depending on what sort of flavours you want to infuse into the spirit as well?
Yeah, the barrels are an incredibly important part of the whole process. And depending on which age profile we're making, we use barrels slightly differently. And here we're always experimenting with new ways of using barrels, new ways of conditioning barrels, and lots to learn, a lifetime of learning, on top of Julian's lifetime of learning.
You grow over 40 varieties here. Is there a secret to the blending, or does it just come down to a lot of practice and a lot of drinking?
Julian is the master blender of apples, and actually the looking over the harvest is one of the most important things. He's selecting which apples are perfectly ripe to blend with which apples, but Julian will tell you the perfect mix for a Somerset cider.
Well, a really good cider apple, something like a Dabernet, which is a local Kingsbury apple, has a very low acidity. It's got a lot of tannin, it's got a lot of sugar, it's got lovely fruitiness to it, but it needs more acidity, and cider making a bit more acidity is better for the yeast to grow. And a lot of the spoilage organisms don't like acidity. So we blend the Dabernet with something like Kingston Black or a Stoke Red or Brown's Apple to give a little bit of the right pH. If you're growing cabbages in your garden, you look at the pH of the soil. And exactly the same for cider making. You need a juice with the right pH, and then you ferment the juice. And later on, we would look at the cider again for taste, which would never really be a balance of tannin. But that is, the Somerset is very short of good acid apples. And we're planting an orchard next year of Porter's Perfection, which is a local apple from a Porter's family in East Lambrook. And hopefully that will give us a source of acid apples in late December, which is we're short of. But the blending of apples is absolutely essential. We used to press apples from an old boy called Frank Yandel from Langport, and he's dead now. But we'll press his apples, or our apples, maybe we'd sell to him. And if we'd just been pressing sort of green apples or red apples, he would have had a deep shock. What he wanted to see was all the colours of the rainbow in the apples that went into his cider. And that is the fundamental part of cider. It's a rough and ready way of doing it, but blending apples is the art and the craft of cider making, and people should ignore it. I mean, it's not a question of taking a single variety and dosing it up with chemics to get that pH right. We should use apples, and it should all be apples. And that's the philosophy of cider making. Some people are debating that at the moment.
I think it's worth saying as well that this area, Kingsbury Episcopi, is one of the vintage areas for cider making. So over the whole country in the early 1900s, they did a lot of research in Long Ashton about fruits, and they discovered that the terroir here is one of the best in the country. So it's three areas they classified as having much better quality apples. One was Kingsbury Episcopi, one was Boltonsborough, and one was Wedmore. And so Kingsbury Episcopi is the only one of those places that still has this huge orchard traditions. There's not very many apples left in the other two places. Right. So really this is the historical heart of Ciderland.
We're just at the start of June, so the blossom is hanging around. It's been a really good year for it, actually. What makes a good year in the world of growing?
It's a very late year for blossom this year. The trees are about 3 weeks late, we think. What makes a great year is a warm spring, early spring, so the pollinators are all out and the blossom sets. We didn't have that this year. We had an incredibly cold April, which might have damaged some blossom with frost. And then we had a terribly wet start of blossom season. This beginning of May was so incredibly wet that the pollinators couldn't get out and about. So a perfect spring would be nice and hot, and then you'd have plenty of sunshine, but also enough rain in the summer. And then harvesting not too cold, because when the apples are on the floor and they get cold and hot, they start degrading.
As well as the weather maybe not playing its part this year, we've also been deprived of the festival season, which is obviously a huge part of your route to market. What on-site kind of activities have you been doing to recreate a part of that feel?
So in that first lockdown, we got the cider bus out that would normally go to Glastonbury and End of the Road, and we put it in the yard, and just to keep us sane more than anything else. And then actually performers have been turning up periodically to do shows in the orchard. So this summer we've opened the orchards for anyone that wants to put on some community entertainment. So we've got bands playing, but we've also got a few world-class circus acts coming. We have got a theatre show, and the cider bus is in the yard every Saturday. So people are really actually coming and making use of the orchards, which is a lovely thing. Lots of picnics and lying around under the trees on hot days, hopefully.
As a new feature for this season, we're showcasing Somerset's musical talent, with tracks from local acts in each podcast. Taylor Tee is a lyrical singer-songwriter who is originally from the West Country, but has spent a good chunk of time in Australia and New Zealand. Selling out shows in Somerset, one reviewer describes Taylor's rustic folk music as finding a balance between providing warmth and nostalgia. From his 2020 EP, this is Learn How to Love.
Smiling, whispered words, eyes this real. In darkness hiding, breaking through, learn how to feel. So close your eyes now, hold your breath and take the leap. And dance with life, go, feel the love, the words I speak. Learn how to love. I know. Learn how to love. Yeah, ooh, I know. Yeah, yeah, now. Sunset seeking, shouting words, what happened here? We lost ourselves in chasing dreams in greed and fear. But an open mind now, all we need, love's all around. So worry not, babe, silence speaks, don't make a sound. One, two, three, four. And I will find you, so don't go running. And I will find you, I look for me. Yeah, ooh, no. Learn how to love. Yeah, ooh, I know. Learn how to love now. Yeah, ooh, I know. Yeah, yeah, no. No. Find you, so don't go running, and I will find you, 'cause I look for me, and I will find you, so don't go running, and I will find you, 'cause I look for me. Look for me.
Looking at the future, is it fair to say that you've always wanted to employ a sustainable approach to farming the land here?
Matilda carries on about sustainability more than I do, possibly. But we need to be aware at all times to be as sustainable as possible.
I think what it is that when Julian started farming, it was the farming that we look on as idyllic farming, you know, not the use of heavy machinery. And if you look at all our tractors, they're all absolutely ancient, and most of them predate you, don't they, Julian? And I think somewhere in the middle, the farming got corrupted, maybe in the 80s, with all the everything being ripped out and huge monocrops, and the farm is completely the antithesis of that. But naturally, because to grow apples and any soft fruit, we also grow cherries, and we're about to grow quinces, you need to encourage diversity in the orchards. And our orchards, these traditional orchards that we grow, are really unintensive, so you don't need pesticides, you don't need nitrogen. And if you go in there, if you walk through the orchards now, you'll see at least 2 green woodpeckers flitting about. And so it's a really amazing ecosystem. So we're aware of preserving it, and especially as we're losing diversity elsewhere, it's more and more important to maintain it here.
Not to use artificial nitrogen, we don't. It's quite revolutionary in the world of farming at the moment. We depend so much on nitrogen, which is hugely CO2 generating, and we don't use obnoxious pesticide sprays in the orchard. We let the bugs, as long as they don't get completely out of hand, find a natural balance. We do have to use some fungicides, because we have some varieties which can get devastated by something called scab, which is wet. In Somerset, we're relatively dry. If we lived in Devon, which is a lot wetter, a lot more unfriendly as far as growing cider apples are concerned. But we're quite lucky. We're quite wet enough naturally, but we wouldn't want to be any wetter. So we do, and we grow standard trees mainly.
They're the tall traditional trees you see here, rather than the small bush trees.
We tend to grow better apples than the... So we're not particularly interested in tonnage. If you're a commercial grower for one of the companies, you'd be on about what tonnage you're committing. We're actually interested in growing special varieties and the quality of what we grow. And standard trees are certainly better for that.
Yeah. Is it also true that you're planting oak trees to use as barrels in the future?
Yeah, but they won't be ready for 130 years' time. So in 130, we've got lots of...
That's quite long-term planning.
There's a lot of long-term planning goes on. In our orchard, we've got our orchard planting plans till 2024, because that's how long it takes to order the trees from the nursery. And then those, we will turn some of that into cider brandy. And that cider brandy, we will think about drinking and selling in 54. So that's the orchard we're planting in 2024. In 30 years later, we'll be selling the 10-year-old cider brandy, because the trees take such a long time to mature.
Yeah.
Then you have the cider making process, then the brandy making process, and the aging process. So it's Julian's planting for 2 generations down,
yes.
And I'm planting for 1 generation down. So.
So for me, it's very important that we get some young blood into the company, and I certainly have been a bit pushed with a health problem this year. I'll get better, but it was a great relief to have somebody to hand over the reins too. Though Don McCullen, who's Somerset's most famous photographer by, I suspect, a long way, said that, looked at it a very sad event that Matilda had come to work on the farm. He thought it was a shocking waste and indicated that's what he thought. Matilda can still photograph things in between doing things on the farm.
So, Julian, after 50 years of doing this, you've hinted at that fact of it being focused on the legacy and kind of what you're going to pass on to future generations. How much of your time is spent on that versus, you know, the year by year activity?
I think the future is a very important thing. We wish and expect to leave Somerset with a new industry to go with cider industry. And certainly I would say that distilling gives our farm a future. When we're dealing with the timescales we're dealing with, storing brandy for possibly 20 years, you do have to think sometimes that a lot of us will be dead in 20 years' time. And the legacy obviously is the ultimate conceit. But we would like to leave a viable orchards with a future. And I think we're on the right track at the moment.
As part of that legacy, you were both invited to take part in the Queen's visit to Somerset a couple of years ago. What was that experience like?
Oh, wow, that was a surprising honour. It was great. We got dressed up. We went there. Julian was sitting four seats away from Her Majesty, and it was a really lovely time. It seems like a lifetime ago now, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was surprising because most of the other Wallers were sort of council Wallers who've done 100 years service. And it was a charming, charming event. A real joy to be chosen to have lunch with the Queen.
On cue.
So that's the Somerset cider clock. It was made in around about 1740 when there was a cider tax introduced to pay for the Seven Years' War in America, where we chased the French out of Northern America. And it left the government with a bill of £3 million. And they decided to tax cider to repay the bill. Anyway, there was a great uprising in the cider world, the whole of the West Country. And they burnt the effigies of the Prime Minister, called Lord Bute. And that clock was made, and if you look on the dial, etched on it, it says no tax on cider. And there's a picture of a parrot, which presumably means the river parrot, and a barrel and an apple tree. So the clock got a new case in 1800 sometime, but the mechanism is all genuinely 1740.
That's fascinating.
Anyway, King George got rid of Lord Bute, and they decided to get this money back by taxing the colonies. And so that resulted very shortly after the Boston Tea Party. The colonists objected to being taxed, and their slogan, no taxation without representation, came out, and shortly afterwards it resulted in the American War of Independence. So we would say without taxing cider, the United States would still have our dear Queen. So the idea to telling Americans that they owe to cider the whole basis of their constitution amuses me.
We've talked about this very much being a family business. How do the two of you work together? What have you learned from each other? What do you bring out?
She's really bossy.
He's really bossy. We actually work really well together. It's much better than we did right at the start, I think.
I no longer have a desk in the office, but I do have some things to do. But that's a great relief to me.
Stopping Julian from working 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, is an impossible task. So. Yeah, we rub along and we do different things, and there's still a huge, huge amount I need to learn. And mostly about the actual orchards and the apples, which is really something that can only take time, because that's the real skill of cider making.
Julian, you're now a grandfather. How do you feel about seeing the next generation of Templeys running through the orchards here, much like your children did when the farm was in its early years?
I have five grandchildren sort of living locally, and I would hope that they all take part in the future. Certainly, being part of the cider world has been a great privilege, and the cider world has been kind to us, and I hope that it carries on over the next few generations. Most of the children seem to be gifted. As I said earlier, that I wasn't what you might call an academic genius. I'm sure we'll have one that has a sort of practical bend. At the moment, I can see all of them all flying off into the stratosphere in a due course. But to be a farmer in Somerset is a great privilege. And I think my friend Mr. Evis said at my daughter's wedding that there was no better thing to be a farmer in Somerset.
I think throughout our lives, Julian's never tried to pull us back to Somerset, which is, there's never been any pressure to come back and be involved, which means that actually all of us have gone off and had lives, and now the last one is just about to move back, I think, so we'll all be close.
Before we wrap up, for those people who, you know, want to find out more about what you're doing, where's the best place to go?
Our website, which is www.somersetciderbrandy.com, or yeah, you can come on a tour here, or come on a Saturday, walk around the orchards, but the website, somersetciderbrandy.com.
Julian, Matilda, thank you so much for your time. It's been fascinating talking to you, and you've been wonderful guests.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.